Welcome back to Not Too Busy to Write. I'm Penny Winsor, author and book coach. Today, I'm speaking with Tamu Thomas. Tamu is someone whose work as a transformational coach I've known for many years, and it is a thrill to speak to her today about her debut book, Women Who Work Too Much. After 15 years as a social worker, Tamu pivoted to coaching in search of a more peaceful and pleasurable life. Tamu brings so much wisdom, joy, and pragmatism to her work, and I love this discussion about natural productivity, boundaries, and why work is not necessarily a bad thing, but can be a part of our self-care, as well as why rest can be a radical act. Tamu is very much speaking my language in this episode, and I think many other writers will resonate so much with her work. Women Who Work Too Much is out now. Links are all in the show notes. If you are itching to get your own expertise into a nonfiction book, my next nonfiction book proposal workshop is on the 27th of March at 7 p.m. Places are just £39 and listeners can get £5 off using the code TOOBUSY at checkout. You can secure your place at pennywinsorwrites.com/workshops, and all of the details to that and as well as links are in the show notes. Enjoy the episode.
Hi, Tamu. Thank you so much for being on the podcast with me today.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It's lovely to be here.
It's lovely to see you. It's been a long time since I've seen you, actually. It's so lovely to have you.
I know.
It's been a while. I want to start, first of all, with your book, Women Who Work Too Much, talks a lot about toxic positivity. And I wanted to start with just how do you define toxic productivity? How do you define it?
Toxic productivity is the almost overwhelming, compulsive, not just desire, but need to be productive all the time. So it's when we talk about things like using your time efficiently. It's people automatically assume it's all to do with work. But when I'm talking about toxic productivity, I'm talking about living a life where everything needs to be productive. There needs to be some kind of quantifiable output, whether that is you feel like you've really grafted or you've got something tangible out of it. So it looks like your friend who invites you and your girlfriends around for dinner, for example, but she never sits down. She's flitting, she's flighting, she's up, she's down. You can't remember her actually sitting down to eat. You put your glass down, you've just about finished it. She's taken the glass, she's rinsed it, it's in the dishwasher. It's that person who you always speak to and you're like, I know you're really busy, but... Or you're trying to book things well in advance because you know this person always has plans. It's that person who is exhausted to their core, but somebody's having something and it's not anything that special and they feel like they need to go to show their face. Mm. It's that person who, again, soul-crushingly exhausted, but it's a nice day and they can't sit indoors and waste the day acting like there's not going to be another nice day. It's that person in the office who always says yes. You can rely on that person. Oh, don't worry, Sheila will do it. Sheila, I know you're really busy, but we've got a new starter. Could you take them under your wing for a couple of weeks? She, through gritted teeth, said, yeah, sure, it's a pleasure. Sheila's overwhelmed already. Mm-hmm. So-and-so is going off to have a baby. Can you organize the office baby shower? And they feel like they need to say yes. A, because saying no feels really dangerous because they haven't had the experience or been taught to have boundaries. B, their identity, their value, their sense of worth is tied up in what other people think of them. And C, because of those behaviors, they've had to suppress so many of their needs, their desires, their dislikes, their wants, their joys, that they don't know how they feel. So feeling anything feels really quite dangerous, quite frankly. So keeping busy keeps those feelings at bay. So it's omnipresent, it's omnidirectional, it's not just in one place. And we're conditioned for it from a very young age. So a lot of the time we don't realize we do it. And I describe it as a symptom of people-pleasing behavior. Like toxic productivity is peak people-pleasing behavior.
I love that you describe it as being so much more than beyond work, because I think some people will possibly recognize themselves maybe in certain aspects of their life. Maybe they're they are overproductive and in certain areas and maybe not so much in others. And so maybe they kind of go, oh, it's fine because, you know, I don't work too hard in at work,
yeah.
but at home they're really overproductive, right?
Yeah.
I would love to dive a bit into your background and how you came to this work. You were a social worker for many years and you were on mm-hmm. the verge of burnout. I don't know how you describe it. And what was it exactly, do you think, that happened that made you say, I don't have to live like this? It can change.
I wasn't on the verge of burnout. When I actually checked it and tracked back to the first time I reached out for support, because mm-hmm. I just felt so exhausted all the time and had a really negative, like my inner critic was wild, was 2009. Mm-hmm. So from 2009 until I left it unchecked from 2009 until 2016. So that was 7 years of chronic burnout, and that was normalized in my profession.
Yes.
When I worked in a workplace and it was the end of my probation. I was like, oh, it's the end of my probation. And one of my colleagues said, oh, you're going to stop being happy now. She was deadpan serious, because you're not supposed to be happy. You're not supposed to be vibrant. You're not supposed to be joyful as a social worker. Looking beat down by the profession was a badge of honor. So it was the embers I was left with. And what led me to say no more, it was a sit again. The allure, the seduction of working too much was very, very strong. So I had a number of things. And two things happened in a relatively short period of time. Number one, my daughter, having a heart-to-heart with my mum, told my mum that when she wakes up to go to the toilet, she often hears, I used to have acrylic nails. She would hear me typing at she felt like it was 3 a.m. It probably wasn't, but it was late. And she said, and I shout at her all the time. I didn't shout, I was snapping, but I understand and recognize to her, she felt like she was being shouted at all the time. And I thought, that's no way I want my child to live. I was very clear that I wasn't bringing my child up. I was loving her up. And I just thought, that doesn't feel loving. And then not too long after that, I kept talking about having anxiety, but I didn't feel like it was real, because the client group I worked with were so disaffected that yes. their anxiety looked so different to what I was experiencing.
Yes.
I just kept pushing it away. And I kept having what I was calling heightened periods of anxiety. And then I think it was 2017, I had a heightened period of anxiety I couldn't ignore. I was on my way to court. It was a very contentious court case, but that was normal. And in fact, I enjoyed that kind of thing, because I am a balanced and fair social worker. I know that I can, you know, that my decisions are based on solid evidence. I haven't been brash in what I've decided. So I was ready for it. It was fine. But I was worried about being late, because it was in a different place and a few other things. And I had this experience where I felt like I was going to die. I couldn't feel my knees. Mm-hmm. My heart was beating so erratically, and it literally felt like it was in my throat. I felt like I sharply inhaled and I'd forgotten how to exhale. And I found myself in my pencil skirt, my high heel shoes and my fitted blazer and my designer bag, holding on to the railing of a bus stop. And I could see people looking at me like, what the heck? Like, this smart woman looks like she's just taken LSD or something. And I thought, this isn't normal, but I had to get to work. I couldn't mm-hmm. let people down. I had to give that evidence. So thankfully I had tools that allowed me to regulate myself enough. I went and did the court case. I gave evidence, did a good job. And I thought, I have to go to the GP. Fast forward, saw the GP, and what they referred me to counseling services, and the GP said that that according to their tests, I was experiencing a severe level of moderate depression. And then I saw the psychologist for an assessment, and they said the severe level of moderate depression was just left unchecked. It manifested as anxiety, left mm-hmm. unchecked, that manifested what I was calling as heightened anxiety, were in fact panic attacks. So my health is what screamed out. My immune system was so compromised. I would have colds from September right through to March. Mm. My neutrophil levels were very low. They're a type of white blood cell. Mm-hmm. They were very, very low. The doctor said, like, you've got to do something about this. Otherwise, we're going to have to take serious measures. And also mentioned that one of the things they do about low neutrophils, if they're really low, is a bone marrow transplant. They inject neutrophils into your bone marrow. And I was like, flipping hell. I don't want my child to witness their mother like this. Mm-mm. Children learn so much more from what we role model.
Yeah.
I also, through my work, had the experience of seeing people having psychotic breakdowns. And there was one person I remember being around, and I thought, how you're behaving, I feel like on the inside a lot of the time. And I just felt like for everything other than work, so for me and my child, I was constantly scraping energy from the bottom of my barrel. And I thought, I grew up seeing women like that. I don't want to role model this. I want her to, in her childhood, know that it's normal to live a life that feels vibrant and where you are able to be energetic. And I just thought, I'm going to work out the minimum amount of money I can live on, and I am going to rebuild and create something new, because money is a worry, especially as a single parent. I was thinking, well, how am I going to make money if I stop doing this? I wasn't in the position where I had like 6 months of living costs saved and all of that. So I did what I do best. I overworked. So I started the coaching business whilst I was doing the social work, and transitioned from one to the other.
There are so many things that I feel similar about when you say that to me. There's so many similar things. But one thing I want to pick up on that you said, and I think is really, really interesting, how you were saying that, you know, you're working with people, you know, as a social worker, who are very vulnerable. And it's probably very easy for people, particularly frontline workers, to compare themselves to very extreme situations and think, well, things aren't that bad. I need to be, you know, I need to keep going. I need to keep functioning because things are not that bad. So it's really interesting, isn't it? I imagine that people who often work on the front line do perhaps have a slightly skewed view of what perhaps is okay in terms of like how we're feeling.
Totally, totally skewed. And whenever I say this, people's eyes light up and they're like, oh my goodness, I feel so seen. So a lot of people that enter into these sorts of professions, whether it is the mental health, social work side of things, or the coaching side of things, there's something within us that is very driven to help and support people. And when we leave that unchecked, and we've got all of this other societal conditioning going on, what actually can be underneath there is very high functioning codependence. So there's, and that high functioning codependence, we just want to, it's not so bad for us. We want to help you. We want to save you. We want to do all of this stuff. So mine was very driven by, not only do I not have it as bad as them, I'm somebody who's got a big capacity for care. And I'm also I've got a lot of energy to go outward. I have trouble bringing it back inward. So that combination meant I felt like I don't have a right. And I would do the cruelest of things. I remember there was one day I was sitting down with myself, and I actually inside myself said, you're a human being just like Oprah Winfrey. Oprah Winfrey does all of this stuff, not taking into consideration the infrastructure. Exactly. So mean to myself.
It's a very mean thing, isn't it? To compare ourselves to other people who have so many more resources than we have. But even to compare ourselves to people that have less resources and expect us to be able to automatically perform, because we can't like perform in a more than somebody who has less resources, because we also, there's so much we can't see anyway from the outside. But it's interesting. I've loved reading this book so much, because personally, I love reading about time and productivity and all those things. I find it a completely fascinating topic, both in a kind of practical level, but also a philosophical level. But I am constantly infuriated by the material that comes out. And let's just say largely by white men in Silicon Valley who have a very particular view of time and productivity that has absolutely no relation to my life as a woman and a caregiver. And I imagine so there's so little to relate in terms of, like, you know, reality to anyone in any kind of marginalized community as well. So it's incredibly refreshing to read something like this from a totally different kind of perspective. Is that part of what you wanted to talk about, to bring a different view, to bring a more holistic view as well to the idea of productivity and time?
I wanted to bring, yes, exactly what you just said. So I'm not going to repeat it. But because I have had a lot of nervous system education as a somatic coach, what struck me as I began my somatic coach training and all the training I've done since then, a lot of the personal and professional development industry goes against our human nature. Mm-hmm. It goes against we're designed. And it's very much this mind over matter, mindset your way through, forgetting we live in our biology first. And a lot of the stuff traditional personal development and professional development will talk about, they'll position things like, you're not doing things because you're not ambitious enough. You're not doing things because you don't want it enough. You're not doing it because you're not organized enough, and all of these other things. Mm. And the truth is, for most of us, even those of us who can suppress our embodied experience and mindset our way through, underneath that, there is a whole world of stuff going on. Mm. Our bodies are like the most technologically advanced piece of kit on this planet, apart from this planet herself. Mm. And our neuroception, like our sensory receptors, are constantly scanning the world for signs of safety and danger. And when we're thinking about things like deadlines and timescales, that's a threat to our nervous system. So we feel unsafe. So a lot of what we call limiting beliefs and all of that kind of stuff is actually our body doing what it's designed to do. Mm-hmm. We feel a threat. So now it's trying to protect us from this threat the best way it knows how, which is over control, keep still, fight or flight your way through. A lot of the personal development world talks about fight your way through, or mm-hmm. flight your way from failure, because heaven forbid if you don't reach these arbitrary goals that haven't been set for you. So I want people to also back a bit. When I work with my clients and I am able to help them understand that their biology is doing what it's designed to do, they shame themselves less, they blame themselves less, and they think, well, okay, what do I need to be productive? What do I need to be able to take action in a manner that is sustainable? And furthermore, what do I even want? Do I want this six-figure career that everybody is talking about? Or do I want something else? Do I want to create a business that gives me enough money to look after myself, look after my family, contribute to my household, whatever that looks like, and be able to pick up my children from school, be able to attend sports day and have a picnic? So when we are in tune with our biology, it helps us understand who we are, what we need, what we want, so that we can then develop boundaries that meet us where we are, rather than always going for this potential, which is always somewhere over there. And we're constantly revving and jacking our nervous systems to be able to get there. It's not sustainable. Mm. And it's part of the reason why we have the most medical advances, the most technological advances, yet we are the most unhealthy. We're the unhealthiest we've been in modern times.
Mm. It's really interesting you say that about biology, because I had Marcelle Farrell on the podcast, who is an author, but she's also a medical psychotherapist. And she said something really interesting to me, which I'm going to paraphrase, and apologies to Marcelle if I get this slightly wrong. But she was saying that she believes that a lot of the issues that we're facing are because humans forget that they are animals. And they live far too much in their minds and forget to actually treat themselves as an animal would treat themselves. Yeah. And that really, really struck me when she said that, as how much that, you know, the power of embodiment. Like if we can actually meet our biological needs and as they are for each of us individually, of how much of a difference that could make to our overall well-being.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, like I say to my clients all the time, we are mammals. It doesn't matter that we live in houses and we drive cars. We are mammals. And when we extend that grace and compassion to ourselves, we build a template that enables us to offer that to other people. So when I'm talking about this stuff, I'm not just talking about it having an impact on the self. We are the self in relation to other people, and it enables us to put other people where they are rather than where we think they should be, often according to our own deficits.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting. But there was something else that I wanted to pick up on in the book, this idea of natural productivity. I really loved reading this section because I think it's really easy to be quite binary about this, that all productivity then is really bad. But you talk about this idea of natural productivity and also this idea that that work can be a form of self-care. And I loved reading that because I've always considered work to be part of my self-care. And it's something that I feel like not everyone understands when I say it. In fact, actually, when my first book came out, because it was about unpaid care, a lot of people did say to me, how do you look after yourself, when I was in interviews and things? And the first thing I would always say is work. Work is one of the ways to look after myself. And in fact, often, you know, people have advised me, oh, well, maybe if everything's a bit hard and a bit too much, maybe you should work less. Maybe that's the problem. Without sort of grasping that work is a big part of how I care for myself. So I really wanted to dive into that a little bit because I know a lot of the writers listening will also feel this, you know, when people are doing work that they care deeply about, it's work that gives something back to us as well as work that we're putting out into the world.
Yeah, my clients, when they first come across me and I say work can be part of our self-care or work can fuel your self, they hate it. They're like, get work away from my self-care. And I'm just like, we work to purchase things that enable us to meet our needs. So work is part of our self-care. And with that shift, with that reframe, we can start to explore, well, if work is part of my self-care, how is it that I have organized my whole life around work when work is supposed to contribute to how I live, which is very, very important. And again, you know, the first chapter of my book, the first sentence is, it's not your fault. It's not your fault. You were conditioned that way. Most of us started school when we were 4 years old. So from the age of 4 years old, and it might have happened before that, epigenetics also may say that it's happened even before we were born, but definitely since we entered those school gates with our pleated skirts and knee-high socks on and buckle-up shoes, we were conditioned to organize most of our waking day around sitting down like a good girl, putting your hand up when the question was asked, churning out work at the deadline set by somebody else. And if you wiggled and squiggled and giggled, you were naughty, you were a problem. So we have been conditioned that way. It's not a choice. We haven't done this deliberately. So a lot of people who describe themselves as type A, I'm like, yeah, that A in type A is for anxiety. We've been taught to use anxiety as a motivational tool. Like it's not healthy. It's not sustainable. So we are conditioned to view life as fitting around work. And we have like nooks and crannies, friendship time, social time, children time. And that's not the way it's supposed to be. Even if you don't like your work, you're doing something that feels like it's a job that pays me money so that I can, that's still part of your self-care.
Yeah.
If you're like you or I, and you are in the privileged position to have been able to create work that you love and enjoy, that work is also then contributing to your emotional well-being, your mental well-being, your stimulation. Penny, there were some times I was writing my book when the world outside stopped and it was me, and it literally felt like there were words being like beamed down from heaven, swirling around my head. I was putting them in order and whoosh, they came out. And it felt like such a beautiful spiritual experience. Sometimes I was moved to almost tears because I was like, I cannot believe that this is what I get to do.
Yeah.
That is part of my self-care. But within that, because you know, ADHD and hyperfocus and me being someone that gets really turned on when I'm being productive,
yeah.
even if it's not anything that is lighting me up that much, I can forget to hydrate myself. Mm-hmm. I can get to like 4:44 and I only eaten breakfast. So I have to put reminders in so that I take care of myself, so I'm not sacrificing my physical well-being for this mental and emotional stimulation.
Yeah.
So I just want to underline our natural productivity back in the day when we were hunter-gatherers and we didn't have, you know, children who wanted Nike Air Max and wanted particular types of furniture in our homes, we would be productive to meet our survival needs. Then we would be in community with each other. Mm. We would frolic. We would play. We would be in connection. We would be in community. We were not designed to be productive for the sake of being productive. It was about productivity to sustain the way we live. Mm. So when we remember that, and we keep reminding ourselves, because we will forget because of how we've been conditioned, mm. we can then start to approach work as if it's part of our self-care and start to ask ourselves the question, even if we're employed and we work for other people, how do I work best? How do I work in a manner that supports my life? So people, when I talk about these things, people think I mean kumbaya, sitting on a lily pad, not doing anything. No. I'm talking about working out what brings out the best in you so that you can put that forward. In the book, I include stats about people who work 9 to 5. Well, statistics show that you work for less than 4 hours a day. You're not using that time productively. So if that is the case, let's be honest and work for 4 hours a day and yep. spend the rest of the time enjoying ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And in the book, you also, in the same section, talk about this idea of the healthy life ethic as opposed to the healthy work yes. ethic. And I loved that
yes.
because it talks about work as a part of our whole selves, a part of our whole life, not the kind of main focus of our lives, which you just summed up so beautifully there. I mean, this is the thing. I mean, I'm very fortunate that I love the work that I do, both the writing and the working with other writers. But also, one of the things I get so excited about is paying my pension. And I know it sounds really strange, but like it makes me, when I see my pension coming out of my bank account, I'm like, I'm taking care of myself. That's the feeling I get when I see it. I love that.
Yeah.
And if I yeah. was unable to work, which many carers, parents of disabled children are not able to work, that's something I couldn't do for myself, amongst many mm-hmm. other things. And mm-hmm. so for me, when I'm feeling quite frustrated with things and I'm feeling like I'm being pulled in a million directions, sort of seeing that figure on my bank statement that's going into my pension, it's like, okay, that's something that yeah. I'm doing for myself right at this moment.
Yeah. Yeah. Similar, like people think it's these grandiose things, but I always say we live in the micro. It's those micro mm-hmm. things we do every day that compound. So my version of the pension is my life insurance. I had an accident on the motorway years ago and I had an out-of-body experience and I wasn't a mother yet. But since that time, when I do a motorway journey, because I still got a bit of that fright inside, like that embodied memory. Mm. I know it sounds so morbid, but one of the things is I've got life insurance. So if anything happens, my child will be okay. And, yeah. and that's self-care for me and her.
Absolutely. Yeah. I, in fact, have 2 life insurance now. This is how lame I am. It's because of that. It's for my peace of mind. It's just for my peace of mind. I've got one that yeah. covers the mortgage, and then I've got one that's a bit of money so that, yeah. you know, because I don't have tons of savings. So yeah. When I see those and I'm like, oh God, look at all my expenses coming out. Oh, the life is so expensive. I think it's okay because I'm doing this for mm-hmm. my peace of mind. It's something that I'm giving to myself. Yeah. And on that idea of the micro, you talk really beautifully in the book about this idea of thinking about a balanced day. And it's really interesting. I've actually done that exercise myself for years of like writing down a day that I would like. And hands down, that is the exercise that I credit with me living my life the way I do today.
100%.
I think that comes down to that idea of like focusing on the actual micro detail of what it what it actually is to do that thing every day, rather than the kind of title of that thing or the accolade, yes, or the kind of abstract idea of that thing. You know, the idea of like when I thought, sat down 5 years ago and I was like, actually, I really, really want to spend my days writing. It was because I sat down and I decided, well, that's actually what I want to spend my time doing, rather than thinking about myself as a writer in the more abstract, yes, way.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And for me, you know, I'm quite an egotistical person. Like, I'm not going to pretend like I'm not. And if I follow that ego, when I'm thinking about, I will think about my ideal day and I will be the president of the world. I will be doing all of these things. When I think about like a day that feels good and satiating for me, like me here in my heart, as opposed to me in my head. Well, actually, that stuff about leadership and all of that, it's not to be leader of the world. It's actually to be holding myself as a leader and inspiring people to be leaders of themselves. Mm. Well, how do I do that? Well, one of the things that comes up immediately is by being a well-rested woman. Like, I talk about being on this quest to be a well-rested woman. I don't know any well-rested women. Even these women online that purport to be well-rested, I ain't buying what you're selling, because you're talking about being well-rested whilst you're sitting on a beach with your laptop, whilst you're poolside doing Zoom calls. I want to be frolicking when I'm in those environments. I don't want to be doing those calls. And I know that when I'm well-rested, I am creative, I'm resourceful, I can see a silver lining in the darkest of times. And Penny, everything I have created that is anything that feels sumptuous in my life has come from a place of being rested, peaceful, and joyful. It's never come from go hard or go home and working until... Like, sometimes the ideas that come from that peaceful, joyful, restful place means that there are times that I'm working into the early hours, because for whatever reason, my creativity likes to turn on at like 10:30 at night, and I allow myself to ride through it because it's finite. It's not my permanent way of being. But working out how you want to live from the moment you get out of bed to the moment you return to bed again at the end of the day helps you recognize what is important and what makes you feel not necessarily good, but present and alive.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that. Paul Dolan, the behavioral scientist, has talked about this idea as well, of how actually as humans, you know, we assess things often from a distance. And we might, our ego gets very involved with that. but actually, if we just sit down and think about, well, you know, maybe I like the title of my job, but actually maybe my job hour by hour is a really awful experience. And that actually we should pay a lot of attention to that hour by hour experience and not just the kind of overarching kind of ideas we have about that job. When I started understanding that, it really changed how I felt about myself and the things I wanted for myself in a way. And also, I guess it gives us a way to figure out what we want, doesn't it?
It gives you a way to figure out what you want. And that stillness, for me, it's like, oh, I can feel the shifting of the tides. So what was great then is no longer great now because of the season of life I'm in, because of the interests I have. It reminds you that life is dynamic. It's not static. So that leader of the world stuff, I think that when you're in your 20s and that's the way, you know, I feel like there are rites of passage. I think there are developmental stages where you have these thoughts and feelings. And definitely, like in the end of the book, I talk about when I heard Tracy Ellis Ross at the Elle Awards, where she talks about my life is mine. Like, now I'm much more interested in a life that feels like mine rather than what I was conditioned for, which was a life I gave away. Like, I'm like, well, what feels good to me? What feels powerful to me? What makes my life feel rich? And quite frankly, a lot of the things I would have talked about previously, they no longer make my life feel rich, because I would be so time poor if I was doing those things. Penny, I like to have naps. I like to sit in the peace garden in my park and look at the interplay between the bees and the butterflies when they're about, and look at what happens when the pigeons are being aggressive towards the squirrels. I love that. That makes my life feel good. I feel like I'm alive. I'm at one with nature. I would much rather that. Like, if somebody actually, so I was working with a coach and he was like, well, if you worked 5 days a week and did da 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 da, you would be able to blah, 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 blah. And I was like, yeah, but I don't want to work 5 days a week. I want to do the best I can working 3 days a week because I want to enjoy my life. Mm-hmm. And he looked at me like I said, Mbongo, Mbongo, they trinket in the Congo. Like he was really baffled. And I was like, but for me, it's about my quality of life. I don't want to do all of this stuff and grind and then have no energy left to enjoy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, 100%, 100%. Because it's really interesting because I think part of why I am constantly assessing those things is, you know, in my situation that I've got with a disabled child, I sort of don't have this thing, which is probably quite easy for a lot of other parents to do, which is, oh, when they're older, you know, when they don't need me as much, when they've moved out. I don't have that with my son. Yeah. In fact, things have sort of only got more complex in lots of ways. And I don't know what the future will look like, but it's certainly not going to just sort of suddenly he'll be off at 18 and, you know, frolicking around the world. That's not going to happen. Yes. So in a way, I've been kind of forced to be like, well, okay, so I haven't got some imaginary time in the future where I'm going to have all this time and all this energy spare. So what can I give myself now? One of the things I loved in the book was your drawing you did of the capacity. Was it the capacity drawing you did, which is the three circles? There was a small, medium, and large.
Yes.
And each of them have black dots in them. And they have the same amount of black dots in them. And obviously with the smallest circle, those dots are quite crammed together. And in the larger circle, the dots have lots of space around them. Yeah. And you use that really beautiful, simple illustration to kind of show how if we can increase our capacity, it doesn't make the things we need to do and all our responsibilities go away. We've still got the same black dots. I will continue to have the same black dots. But what I worked out a while ago was that actually I can create space around those black dots.
Yes.
And in some ways that was like, that's one of the sort of privileges of being in a situation where you're sort of slightly forced to confront some of those challenges rather than saying, oh, at some point in the future, I will address these things. I will retire. I will have more time. Yeah. I will do these things in the future.
Yeah. Yeah. And for me, it is. So that diagram, I was thinking it came from my Sovereign Group Coaching program where I was talking to people about widening their window of tolerance because there's a lot of times where like your window of tolerance is how much capacity you have. Mm. And what I was observing is that we mistake our capability with our capacity. Mm-hmm. In my mind, I'm capable of all sorts, but in this finite vessel, I don't have the capacity for all sorts. And it forces you to consider what is important. And, you know, I talk about the trinity of oppression a lot in my book, patriarchy, capitalism, and white supremacy. They encourage us to embody these really infantile states of dreaming, oh, when it gets better, if only. And I'm encouraging us to tell ourselves the truth, to step into the reality and look at things as they are and say, with this, I have, like, by no means am I saying you're not going to be as busy as you previously were. But where can you let things go that are not important? And what can you do for yourself to expand your capacity, not so that you can ram more in, so that you've got more spaciousness around what's going on? You know, I have my child is now 17. My young adult is now 17. And no, I'm not taking her to school and doing the school run and all of that. However, the other day, she went to a party and, you know, I'm an early to bed type of person and I've got like matchsticks in my eyes, keeping them open to collect her at 12:30. So it's like, well, if I'm going to be doing that, I can't be doing the 5 a.m. wake up. And I don't do 5 a.m. wake up because I'm part of the 5 a.m. wake up club. I don't do it for fun. The way my brain works, I'm so much better when I start and end my day early than starting and ending the day later. So it's literally about what is the beautiful, messy, complicated, imperfectly perfect reality of my life? And what can I do to expand my capacity so that I can handle what is inside my life, not ram jamming it with more stuff? Yeah. You talk about, in the book, I've also got this diagram about 360 system care. And I break it down. We overemphasize resilience in our culture. Resilience is supposed to be something that enables us to bounce back. We're not supposed to live in resilience. And when we allow ourselves to bounce back and have a look at what's going on, we then enable ourselves to create space. Mm. And when we have more space, we can properly take a look at our lives and then start to employ choice, start making powerful choices. But we end up stuck in this resilience, which is literally the zone of fight or flight. And because we get quick, I don't really like this word, as you know, because you've read the book, but I can't think of anything else. We get quick failures. We get quick success in that zone of resilience. We get instant gratification either way. And what I'm inviting us to do with this book is to begin to make peace with uncertainty so we can actually start to look at what wants to emerge so we can make choices and decisions from an individual level and at a governmental level on the reality of being a human being. Mm. One of my catchphrases is, we don't need more self-improvement, we need systemic change. But in order to have systemic change that is actually suited to the human beings we are, we need to start asking broader questions and waiting until we get an answer instead of trying to squash everything down with a solution that's not appropriate.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I wanted to ask you a bit more about the writing process itself. You are running a business, you're a mother, you like to have some space and some rest in your life and you prioritize it. What was the process like of taking on a big project like writing a book? I know this is something I like to ask a lot of writers that come on because it can be quite overwhelming, but also, you know, it's a big chunk of work, but often in a really kind of condensed period of time. What was the process like for you?
It was everything, everywhere, all at once. I keep using that term, but it was the most blissful, heavenly creative experience. And at times it felt like I was being dragged across hot coals. And the dragged across hot coals tended to be when I slipped out of writing the book that was being written through me and wanting to prove this, wanting to sound like I know stuff, wanting people to know that I'm clever. There was one time I was like, Tammy, what are you doing? You're not a neuroscientist. And I was like, oh, yeah, I'm not a neuroscientist.
And you don't have to be.
Exactly. So once I was able to, like, I had to keep checking in with myself.
Yeah.
Also, I had a lot of support. So I had a developmental coach I was working with. And because I know myself and I'm just like, I'm so over being ashamed, I was just like, when things get sticky, I hide. So if you haven't heard from me, check in with me, find me. I will respond. But it's like I talk about it being like I'm at the bottom of a well and I can't move and I can see activity at the top. So just drop an anchor down to the bottom of the well, check in with me. I've got a therapist. I've been having weekly therapy since 2020. And my therapist works with a lot of creative people, writers, etc. So I had the support of her. Lots of people talk about having a really challenging experience with their publishers. My commissioning editor is an absolute dream. Hay House have been really supportive. So I know that a lot of the things we try to do on our own, we come unstuck because we're not supposed to do stuff on our own like that. Yeah. We're the most pro-social creatures on this planet. And also, I dropped some of my work. Yeah. Whatever I could do in a manner that could be repeated without me being there, I did that. And my income went down. Like, I have to be perfectly honest with you.
Yeah.
But that's the beauty of knowing actually how much money I need to live on.
Yeah.
And I allowed myself to. So on the outside, it looked like I was busy, but I didn't feel like I was really busy. I've been posting on social media pretty much every day since like 2011. It doesn't feel like if I don't do it, it feels like I'm not doing like what's become my routine. So that didn't feel that challenging for me. Where my challenge was that critical voice that would compare me to Oprah coming in, knocking me off. So I made sure I had support around me. And I've got really great friends who I could just send a voice note to and say, I hate this book today. And they'd be like, okay, tell me more. They wouldn't be like, oh, no, you don't. Or they're just like, tell me more. And they just knew that be able to like verbally rah about the book would just clear out what needed to be cleared out so that I could get back to it. And making sure I was going to the gym, strength training and yoga were like non-negotiable. I had to.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Well, first of all, I wish every writer, and I know I speak to writers occasionally that are like, oh yeah, no, I didn't know any writers until I published my first book. And then I started meeting them and how lonely they were that they couldn't do that voice note of, this book is driving me crazy, which it's so important. That kind of community is so important. I know there are probably some writers listening who don't have that yet. I hope this podcast is a little bit of that for those people. I know for me, when I first started writing again after many, many years where I hadn't written, listening to podcasts, it was almost that little bit of that toe in the water of community that I needed to kind of feel like I wasn't completely alone. But yeah, I think having that community is so important, isn't it? Of someone who's not there to kind of fix it for you, but can just listen to those worries and those very peculiar worries of writing a book, which are quite peculiar.
Being obsessed with a word. Being obsessed with a word. Oh my goodness. Being obsessed with this, obsessed with it. And I'm very fortunate. I've got lots of writer friends. And one of my friend, Donna Noble, she said, Tamu, what I want you to know is you can't write and edit at the same time. Just write. You've got an editor. That's their job. Just get on with it. And also having an older child made all the difference because I was asking her to read things because I thought if she was 16 at the time, if it makes sense in your 16-year-old brain, and she would offer me ideas, we would do things together. She would test things for me. So but something I would say, I would encourage people to be bold. I would joke and say Instagram is my friendship bench, but I reach out to people. Like even just last year, I reached out to somebody. We had conversations and whatnot. And I just thought, we've been flirting with each other for long enough now. And I sent her a message and I said, this might sound really odd, but would you like to explore being my friend? And now we're friends and we're able to have those sorts of conversations. So I think if we can build the courage to be vulnerable enough to just seek out what we want, like even some of the writing, I reached out to some of the people in my community and said, does anybody fancy meeting at 6 a.m. in the mornings? Don't have to write a book. Maybe you're doing your journaling, maybe you're doing whatever, so that we're present together on a Zoom call doing our own individual work. And it made such a difference.
I love that. I absolutely love that. And in fact, actually, I was just talking about this actually with the group of nonfiction writers that I'm working with at the moment. This idea of, the friends I have in the writing and publishing community, I have pretty much made them all online. We've just talked about each other's books and sent each other messages about how much we enjoy each other's work. And then that sort of evolves into conversations. And my whole writers group, actually, we basically all sort of became friends on Instagram over the years, I think. And now we're, meet up in real life and stuff. But it's when you're vulnerable. And I think even as much as just, telling people that you really enjoy their words and that you really enjoy what they do and what they're putting out into the world can start something beautiful, definitely. Well, so your book, Women Who Work Too Much, is it will be coming out. It'll be out, I think, when the podcast comes out. It's absolutely brilliant. It feels like a total breath of fresh air to talk about this from a totally different perspective. I enjoyed it so much. Thank you so much for writing this book.
Oh, Penny, you have people that you have your eye, like, pardon my analogy, but it's like you're year 7 in secondary school. So you're like the smallest in secondary school. And then there's like the big girls who are in year 11. It's like having a nod from a year 11 girl. You're a seasoned writer. You support other people to write. I love your words. I think that your approach, full stop, is so utterly beautiful. So to hear you say that just feels like if I was a crying person, I would have like some tears for the tears are inside. So thank you so much.
Honestly, I mean, anyone listening, and this is, it's such a breath of fresh air. I am going to be honest and say there are books around this topic generally that I sometimes have to throw across the room. Because, you know, because I'm like, I'm sorry, dude in New York, really wealthy, you know, with a
with
wife,
doing all your work.
You don't know about time in my life and about productivity. Oh, no, 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 no. So this honestly was a complete breath of fresh air. You know, we didn't even go into this whole idea of talking about how our individual identities and being a minority or being, you know, having a marginalized identity can so affect, you know, productivity and things and epigenetics and so many other wonderful things that are in the book. We didn't even go there. So please, listeners, go ahead and buy the book. It's excellent. And where else can people find you if they want to find you?
Instagram is still the place I show up the most. So I'm there at tamu.thomas. And also I've developed a penchant for TikTok. So I'm on TikTok. I'm Tamu_Thomas on TikTok. Because TikTok, you can just pick up your phone and say what you want and go, which is great for somebody like me who has an idea a minute and wants to just get it out really quickly and go.
Amazing. So, yeah. I'm going to put both of those links in the show notes. Thank you so much for being with me.
Thank you very much, Jenny. Thank you.